Hello and welcome to the FinTech Newscast. My name's John, and with me as always is Steve.
Hello, John. How's it going?
Good, good so far. And actually great for the podcast today. We're lucky to have Ron Shevlin, senior contributor at Forbes and director of research at Cornerstone Advisors, as well as the author of the FinTech Snark Tank. Welcome to the podcast.
Thanks. Good to be here with you guys.
Well, it's great to have you on the podcast, and you have some really interesting articles on Forbes, which is how I follow you. And one recently that caught my eye was one titled Banks Don't Have to Innovate, which I'm sure is great for getting those clicks. You have to tell me about that too. It's about how banks can kind of follow along and move with the wider innovative trends without necessarily having to be like a fintech. Can you tell us some more about that?
Sure. A couple of things that are going on in the thought of why banks don't need to innovate. First, you know, I'm trying to slap these guys upside the head a little bit to say, let's look at the world a little differently instead of jumping on this innovation bandwagon. But there are a couple of things I was trying to point out in that article. First of all, there was some research that was done a couple of years ago, I think it was by some Wharton professors, looking into innovation. And one of the things they found was that a lot of the innovators in various spaces, not just in financial services, were often acquired by the incumbents in that particular industry. So really what was happening as they looked at the impact of innovation was that the incumbents were not necessarily getting disrupted or displaced. They were actually the ones doing the acquisition, and that new innovations were being assimilated into not just existing firms' offerings, but assimilated into the existing technologies. And their recommendations were that for incumbents, and again, this is not just financial services, but it applies, that there were three things that they really needed to do: monitor, acquire, and deploy. And when they used the word acquire, they did not mean purchase the company, they meant purchase the technology. And you know, if you think about what the vast majority of banks in the US and credit unions do around technology, they're doing exactly that. They're monitoring what's out there, they're acquiring it, they buy technology from the vendors, and then they deploy it. These calls by all the pundits who said banks must innovate or die is kind of wrong. And it's not what they have to do. They have to monitor, acquire, and deploy the innovations as they mature and become important, but they don't need to run off and innovate. Now, the second piece of this is really what's kind of going on within a lot of the financial institutions. You know, there's a lot of angst among bank and credit union executives that they're somehow falling behind the times, they're falling behind some of the leaders and falling behind some of the fintech players that are emerging. And so in order to appease the board, they tell the board, yes, we're innovating, we have innovation projects. And so that they turn around and tell the rest of the company, go, we need to innovate. And what the rank and file hears when the executive team says we need to innovate, they hear, they want us to go off and invent something new. When really what the executive team is saying is we need to change, we need to do things differently. So part of the whole problem we've got here in this is that it's a definition problem. As I joked in the article, you remember the movie Cool Hand Luke with Paul Newman? And he's out in the field, and I think they were out in the field. Maybe they weren't out in the field in this particular scene. But the captain, who actually doesn't have a name, he's just known as the captain, says, what we've got here is a failure to communicate. And that's exactly what's going on in a lot of financial institutions, is a failure to communicate. You know, the executive team runs out and says, we need to innovate, and does not give specific enough directions to the rank and file when the real direction is we need to be doing things a little bit differently, and we need to be better, faster at monitoring, acquiring, and deploying the innovation. And also to your point, John, I can tell you that in all the Forbes articles I have published in the almost 2 years that I've been publishing it there, this one got like one of the worst number of page views. You know, the best ones are the ones where
really?
I, you know, pander to the crowd and tell them what I want to hear. Nobody wants to hear you don't have to innovate. So this one did not do well. So, you know, everybody listening needs to go out and pump up my page view hits on this one to make me and my wife feel a little better about this one.
I've been clicking on it this whole time, actually. So, and different browsers and
Yeah, Google punishes me for that though, because your page length time isn't very long. So, but I appreciate the thought.
So that kind of points to more like a cultural kind of issue where, you know, I feel like you should be looking for things that contradict your existing preconceptions, things that challenge you, so you can build a better intellectual fortress, because you're constantly plugging holes in your thinking. But am I just not normal that way? Or most people, when you point something out like that, they're not receptive to it?
Yeah, I'm going to challenge that thought a little bit too. I've got a buddy who publishes a lot of stuff and just published an article saying that digital transformation efforts can't succeed without a, quote, culture of innovation. And I just think that's wrong. I mean, he actually did research that found that 56%, or actually no, it was 50, about a little over half, whatever the exact number was, a little over half of the firms that he has surveyed said that they are seeing the expected results from their digital transformation efforts. Well, there's just no way that more than half of the banks he surveyed have a culture of innovation. So how is it that they can be succeeding if they don't have the culture of innovation that he says is necessary? And he's not the only one. That's a very common kind of claim out there. So we need a culture of innovation. But, you know, here's what I would always challenge the bankers with. They said, do you know why fintech firms have a culture of innovation? It's because they have no clients they have to take care of. It's real easy to be innovative all the time when you're not fighting fires every day because your clients are calling with issues or problems or things like that. So it's easier to have that culture of innovation. Second of all, I would argue is if you have a culture of service, and you know, if you're really dedicated to providing super great, you know, service to your customer base, then you probably do already have a culture of innovation, because you recognize that your customers' needs change over time and that new technologies are coming in. We have to deploy those technologies to meet those changing needs. So this idea of we have to have a culture of innovation is a little overblown. And the third thing I would throw out there to kind of counter this is, I mean, look, most banks, believe it or not, are not particularly large organizations, with the exception of, say, the top 30 banks. You know, most mid-sized banks, even, you know, at a billion or, you know, $2-3 billion in assets, they're not big companies. They're not Citibanks. They're not Wells. But they still have an established culture. And of course, the larger companies like a Wells Fargo, Bank of America, I mean, these are very ingrained cultures. Do you know how absolutely ridiculous it is to think that you can write some magazine article and say, oh, you know, banks have to change their culture? Do you know how long that takes to do? The idea is if the pressure is on changing and innovating in the next year or two, 12 to 18 months, you're not going to change the culture that fast. So what are you supposed to do? Wait until your culture has changed to have a culture of innovation and then start doing it? It's a nonsense recommendation. There are plenty of successful companies and banks out there that are doing smart things and implementing good technologies and seeing great results that would not say that they have a culture of innovation. They may have a very dysfunctional culture for all we know, but this is just one of those consultant type things that they love to jump on and are absolutely wrong about.
Oh, we know. Some of them are very dysfunctional. We've seen it up close. So you're saying maybe a culture of focusing on the customer and their needs is more important.
Well, you can argue it depends how you what the culture is today. But my argument is, if you truly have a culture, I mean, I'll give you a good example of a company I think has a good culture of service, which is USAA. And it's funny, I know some folks who work there, and if they were listening to this, they'd probably be chuckling going, if you only knew the problems we had here. But that every company has sort of problems and issues like that. But, you know, when I got a real close-up look at the operations at USAA, it's super impressive. You know, they know who their customer is. It's military members, but even more importantly, they design their operations around the deployed military member, because those are unique needs. And the reality is if they can serve the needs of the deployed military member, then they're probably meeting most, if not all, of the needs of the non-deployed military member, and then in turn meeting plenty of the needs of former military members or the families of military members. And so it's a similar thing here. Is forget about focusing on changing your culture, and focus on serving the needs of a certain set of customers or various sets of customers, so that you're focusing on their needs. It's not about the figuring out how to change your culture. Now, there are things that will have to be done to change in an organization, like organizational structural changes and, very importantly, rewards and incentives. But that'll go a long way to changing the culture. But the idea that, you know, the culture is so important and we have to change this, you know, there are ways to do it. And I think it gets in the way of a lot of change initiatives in a lot of banks.
So monitor, acquire, and deploy. So you just have to remember to be mad, right?
Mad, get mad.
Yeah, okay.
Schemat, interesting. But what about the notion here that maybe creating an innovation group, where I used to work for a giant bank, that creates sort of a sandbox place where you can test ideas, maybe export them to the bank without actually needing to have widespread organizational-wide culture changes, and just sort of a more... more of a sandbox approach.
Yeah, there's absolutely nothing wrong with that. And for a lot of organizations, that's a great idea. You don't want to simply have them focus on innovation, though. You want to have them focus on solving business problems or meeting dealing with business opportunities. It isn't about the innovation that makes it successful. It's about the end result of doing something. And so, you know, I've seen a number of financial services organizations create these innovation groups. And when I ask, well, what are you kind of focusing on? It's like digital account opening. Like, well, you know, there's only a gazillion vendors who will do this already for you. Well, you know, why do you need to get an innovation group to solve a problem that's already been kind of solved? Go, well, that's exactly what we're doing. We're looking at the vendors. I'm like, so you're doing a selection project. Anybody can do that. Everybody does that. But they do it in the innovation group. And so, I go back to an earlier comment that I think a lot of that is there to appease the board to a certain extent. But the idea of the sandbox is very interesting if you kind of play it out. Interestingly, I worked for a consulting firm about 25 years ago whose business approach to doing a lot of change management, and back then it was re-engineering was the rave of the day, not journey mapping and innovation groups. But it was really the idea that we had there was about creating greenhouses, which was create a, you know, an opportunity, you know, a certain set of customers that you can apply the new technologies and new approaches to, see how it works, see what the issues are for rolling up, and then scaling it up and migrating it back out to the rest of the organization. And if that's what the sandbox is doing, I think that's a great approach and a great idea, you know, but you have to recognize that the challenge isn't just going off and testing new technologies. The challenge is in scaling it up and integrating it, merging it, assimilating it into the rest of the organization. When I've looked at what a lot of the large banks have been doing around their innovation groups, what I've really found in a number of cases, and I won't use any names here, but you know, what they're really doing is simply looking for investments. You know, they're creating VCs within the bank to make investments in these companies where the economic payoff is not by operationalizing or productionalizing the technology into their own operations, but to sell them off. So, I mean, look, if that's what they want to do, there's money to be made, that's great, but it's not really changing the operations of the bank. So, you know, this idea of the innovation group can be good if it's focused on business problems and opportunities, without, but if it's going to devolve into, well, let's just go play with cool technology so we can tell the board and the public that we're being innovative, then that's probably a lot of wasted time and effort.
Yeah, I've got to say that from my experience, I think that a lot of what the innovation group did or does is just sort of, you know, show shiny new toys to the board members and say, hey, we're working on blockchain and AI and VR and AR, whatever. And most of that stuff ultimately didn't come to market, right? It just didn't find a way into the bank's core operations. So I think this makes sense. And it's also worth noting here that if you look at, you mentioned the account opening space as well. We saw this trend, right? Both during COVID and after COVID, where most of the new account openings actually happen with the mega banks, not with the fintechs, right? So it seems like there's sort of a disconnect here between the need to drive innovation, have innovation groups and explore new ideas, and actually the reality, which is that the banks are getting bigger and it seems like most of the new deposits are going to the bigger places, not the smaller upstart, innovative jeans and t-shirts sort of fintechs.
That has been true up until recently, but you know, I've conducted a couple of consumer surveys this year, one in January and one in July, and looked specifically at fintech adoption, or really more specifically, challenger bank or slash neobank adoption and utilization. And in the last survey I did, I asked consumers a couple of different questions to get at some, you know, more of a time series of things. I asked, you know, when did you last open an account? And who did you open that account with? And, you know, tried to get more of the history of their account opening going back a few years. And so I can kind of, I looked at it in terms of Q2 2020, Q1 2020, the second half of 2019, and then mid 2018 through mid 2019, and then mid 2017 to mid 2018. And that was not really kind of specified. I just sort of asked, you know, what have you done in the last 3 months, 6 months, 12 months, 2 years, and 3 years? That just by doing the survey in July, that's how it came out. And there's a chart that's in one of my Forbes articles on digital bank adoption. And, you know, it's an interesting picture. If you look at the, you know, the graph and look over time at the percentage of total applications that have gone to the mega banks, and we're talking now three banks, the Bank of America, Wells Fargo, and JP Morgan Chase. They have grown, they accounted for about 53% of all of the new bank applications in Q2 of 2020 during the height of the pandemic. But it wasn't a huge jump from Q1. It was just a steady growth from 2018 through Q2 of 2020. There was a similar increase, though, in the percentage of accounts being opened with the challenger banks, you know, the Chimes, the Varos, the Money Lions, and so forth. And they actually accounted for 18% of all the applications in Q2. So they're, you know, yes, they started off pretty low back in 2018, 2017 or so, but they're continuing to grow on a quarter-to-quarter basis. Where they're getting, both of those categories are getting their business from, are the community banks and the credit unions, in particular the community banks, who are really kind of hurting. There's one other thing that I want to throw out there as a contributor to this trend, though. In the last survey I did, I asked consumers, how many checking accounts do you have? And about a little over a third of consumers have more than one checking account. And that's really different behavior from, you know, even 5-10 years ago. I'm a baby boomer. When we got out of college, we dumped our student checking account. We got a new checking account. And we had one checking account for the rest of our life. Today, it's very different. Consumers are opening up multiple checking accounts for various reasons. They're looking for better interest rates. They're looking for better debit card rewards. They're looking for better personal financial management tools. Sometimes they're opening up that additional account because they get an incentive when they open some other product. So there's a lot of reasons that are driving this. But with the advent of easy money movement, it's no big deal to have multiple accounts. Now you just kind of move the money around real easily. And so when we look at the percentage of accounts that are being opened, you have to keep in mind that, you know, people are opening accounts in some cases with the intention of that becoming their primary account, and in some cases with the intention of it being a secondary or even third or fourth account. So there's more accounts being opened up, which is opening the door for a lot of the challenger banks to gain some market share and gain new customers.
So you alluded to this earlier, but basically it sounds like a two-front war, right? You have the mega banks on one side and the fintechs on the other, and you mentioned this as well, but where does this leave the regional banks and the community banks as well?
Well, and you have to throw the credit unions in there too, because right. they're an important group. And, you know, to a certain extent, you know, it's really tough for the community banks. I'd be hard pressed to give you a percentage, but look, there's a good number of community banks in the U.S. who've pretty much given up on competing in the retail market for retail consumers. They look at the retail market simply as a way to gather deposits, but they're not really competing for those customers' business. They just want deposits to fuel their commercial lending efforts. Maybe it's a little more than half, but it's probably no more than 75%. And I would guess it's more about half that are kind of giving up on this. And so it's tough for them. They'll, you know, will have to find more expensive ways to get deposits when the lending market comes back. Things were, you know, the lending market was pretty good up until recently, and it was struggle to get deposits. And then things just completely flip-flopped when everybody pulled money out of every place they had it and threw it into deposits. And now everybody's flush with deposits but can't find anything good to do with it. You know, the credit unions, to their credit, no pun intended, do a pretty good job of trying to keep up with, especially the larger ones, with the technology that's going on. But look, here's the reality. If you're a mega bank, the mega banks are banks that have generally more than $2 billion worth of assets. So, and they roughly spend about 1% of that on marketing, which means, you know, they have $2 trillion in assets, and they spend 1% of it on marketing. So they're spending $1 billion a year on marketing, and about 4 to 5, maybe even 6 or 7 times that much on IT and technology. So look, reality is that if you're a mid-sized financial institution like a community bank or a credit union, you can't compete with Citibank. You can't compete with Bank of America, Wells Fargo, Capital One. These firms, they buy design firms. Capital One acquired a design firm. So while you're going out and interviewing, you know, 3 local guys, you know, think that they're a design firm and can do website design and app design for you, you know, Capital One has gone and acquired one of the premier firms in the space. Reality is that a mid-sized bank or credit union can't possibly spend enough money, you know, to keep up with the features and functionality that the big banks are offering. And the challenger banks have the benefit of, well, all their money is going to digital development. They don't really put that. There's no branch investment that's needed. And, you know, they still have to provide some sort of phone and contact center support, but I'm not even sure how much money they're putting into that these days. And so, you know, it's a real challenge for the mid-sized institutions, and it's requiring them to kind of really focus in and hone in, just like I mentioned with USAA, find the spots of the market where the bigger institutions are overlooking or will, by definition, have to overlook by having mass market tools. You know, so give you some examples. I think there's a huge opportunity for mid-sized financial institutions to serve gig economy workers. You know, these are a unique set of banking needs that these consumers have. Their income fluctuates greatly. It's very unpredictable when they're going to make money, and that causes them a lot of issues and pain that most banks just don't have good answers for. So go develop some products specifically for that segment. And, you know, there's other types of segments as well. It could be teachers and things like that. It doesn't have to be, you know, job related. But, you know, for the smaller institutions, and I'm not talking about the smallest, even the 1 to 10 billion asset range, they're going to have to start finding the niches in the market to serve, because competing with the big guys is getting to be economically impossible.
Yeah, that's a really interesting point. I'm wondering, is there anything that they can offer in terms of features to kind of achieve the growth that you mentioned as well? I think that one of the things that I've noticed recently is that there's been a lot of emphasis, both by the mega banks and the mid-sized banks as well, on financial health and sort of offering what I call non-core banking services. Would that be the right path for these companies to go, so that they can actually achieve more success in the market, as opposed to just offering straight financial services, you know, which they have done for the past 150 years or so?
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, I don't care what label you put on it, financial health or not, you know, there are ways, and these are things these are, I'll give you a list of a couple ideas I think they can go do. But in all of these cases, you know, these are not things that the bank or credit union has to go off and develop and create themselves. These are about partnering with some of the fintechs that are out there who are looking for bank partnerships and ways to utilize the scale and distribution that, many banks and credit unions have. You know, things like, you know, bill tracking and bill negotiation. There's a company called Bill Shark. I think Mark Cuban's an investor in it.
I love Bill Shark. Yeah.
Yeah. Great tool, you know, that, you know, banks could start to integrate into their offerings. It would also might help them start driving some of the bill pay behavior back to their sites. Because we've seen a real exodus of bill pay behavior away from the banks and to directly to the billers. You know, things like earned wage access. I don't know, it's a kind of a clunky term, but, you know, many consumers rely on payday loans. This is basically an approach where you get access to the money you've already accrued from your, you know, job ahead of your paycheck. You know, so, you know, there's like Chime offers, you know, 2-day early access. That's great. But, you know, what if, you know, you get paid once a month and you need it in week two or week three? There are some companies out there that provide this service called earned wage access, where basically, you know, you've accrued a certain amount of money and you can get that. It's often for a, you know, very reasonable fee. They're not even charging interest. And it basically comes out of your paycheck at paycheck time. So you're getting the money you've already accrued or earned in advance. You know, there are tools out there that do automated savings like Digit and so forth. You know, these are tools. I think there's a couple banks I've seen that are you know, trying to integrate that in. Cash advances, you know, even cryptocurrency purchasing. You know, another research point that I looked at recently was 15% of Americans say that they own some sort of cryptocurrency, Bitcoin, Ethereum, or something these days. I've had some pushback on that from some of the so-called experts in this space who say that number could be is pretty high. But all right, let's say it's, you know, 12% or 10%. Reality is that's still a good percentage of consumers, especially since they skew younger. A lot of the banks are always looking for, you know, how can we attract more millennials and now Gen Zers to our institution? And so offering cryptocurrency buying and investing services, you know, can be a real important way of attracting a particular segment of market who's looking to do that. You know, if you look at Square, you know, their Cash App, you know, a huge, huge percentage of the profitability and revenue they've generated from Cash App in the past year has come from cryptocurrency investing. So, you know, you got some of the players out there and, you know, Square's not going to partner with you, with the banks, you know. The banks are going to have to find other partners to do those things. So again, whether it's financial health under the financial health umbrella or just, you know, particular types of niche services that can help help them differentiate their offerings. There's a whole bunch of things that the banks and credit unions can be doing to serve various niches. But the thing I worry about is that they'll just sort of go run off and, you know, talk to five of these fintechs, and whoever the first one is that says they're willing to play in the sandbox will go do it without them thinking through, well, we need to prioritize this. Who are we really going after here? Who's this going to play to? So that's part of my concern with the innovation groups, is that they're not necessarily driven by a good consumer focus and consumer segmentation approach.
Pretty interesting. Going back to the financial health issue now, you know, there's all these things you've mentioned in terms of earned wage access and paycheck advance and all these services, which seem to address the issue of financial health. And the fact that, and I know that according to your research, you found that, you know, 1 in 5 Americans are essentially in dire financial straits nowadays. Do you, and this is more, maybe more of a philosophical or a policy question rather than a fintech question, but are they even able to address the issues with the segment? Is a technology solution the way to do this, or do we need a more structural approach to actually fix the issues that are driving all these adverse financial health outcomes?
Yeah, when you say they, you mean like the financial institutions?
Correct.
So I think what it really comes down to is that the problem of financial health in the US is not a problem it's not a problem for the banks to solve. And maybe that's too rough a statement to make, but at the least, it's certainly not a problem they're going to solve by themselves.
Yeah.
They're not the cause of the problem. And I know there's a lot of people who hate the banks, and, you know, love to point out, oh, but there are consumers who are paying, you know, $150 a month on overdraft fees. Yes, that's true. It is nowhere near the majority of consumers. So this is not the problem, you know, as widespread a problem. And the reality is that these are the same people who are spending $250 a month, you know, for their cable bill. You know, look, that's a much bigger problem. It's ridiculous how much the telecom companies charge us for cell phone access and access to our cable and things like that and Wi-Fi. You know, that's a much more impact on our finances than you know, the $5 a month we pay for fees to access our checking account. On the other side of the coin, you know, I've been arguing for a long time that taking more of a financial health management approach is a better strategy for the banks, because today they're pushing and selling products. They're selling a checking account, they're selling a loan, they're selling a savings account. But if they, you know, change that to a much more financial health management approach, then they can really, you know, first of all, they would achieve the cultural transformation that, you know, so many people want them to achieve. But it really kind of changes the game and helps them to change the economics of their business, because then they're no longer as reliant on, you know, having to sell one more product to make more money. They can be sort of the intermediary to, you know, just like Amazon is. Look, Amazon makes a hell of a lot of money, not because we spend a lot, give Amazon the money, but because they're a platform to buy all the things we buy. Similar kind of case with banks. Let's want to see them become financial health platforms where they're integrating all the things we talked about, like Bill Shark and Digit and Earned Wage Access and cash advances from Empower Me and things like that. And so there's an opportunity to kind of really transform the game and help improve financial health. I think there's a couple of things that, you know, are necessary kind of infrastructural things that we need to get there, though. Number one is we need a more standardized score, or really set of scores, to measure financial health. Today, a lot of the approaches out there are, some are good, but many are kind of overly simplistic and not very good. They're, you know, almost sort of just marketing front ends, and not real good from a management tool perspective. Second is, listen, I have, in a number of surveys that I've conducted, attempted to measure and quantify financial health. And every time I do, I recognize that I'm not even why I keep doing it. I'm asking consumers to tell me, you know, what their situation is. And many people don't know, or they don't have, you know, the real insight into their situation. And so we need a better sort of data aggregation. I want to see the players like MX, who've done a lot of stuff. I should give them a lot of credit for that. But the Plaids, the Yodelies, the Finicities of the world, who are, you know, helping to create all the interconnections, is to really kind of bring that data together, not just to simply, you know, provide an aggregated view of accounts, but to provide a better view into financial health. And I think that'll, you know, really start to kind of change things. Listen, I'm a free market guy, so I don't want to see the government get in this. To my view, every time the government gets into something, they just screw it up. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I don't think the government's gonna. I don't think policy decisions here are really going to change the game. Every time we see a regulation come down the pike, basically, look, the reality is that the banks and the industry, from a technology perspective, are far ahead of the regulators, and anything the regulators are going to throw out, you know, the banks will react and find a way to get around it and to continue to make money. So, you know, if the idea is, well, we need to start regulating financial health. And it's interesting, there's been an interesting proposal put out by a couple of really smart guys, Todd Baker and Corey Stone, who used to work for the CFPB. And they're basically advocating exactly that banks be regulated and, you know, in effect, forced to prove that they're having a positive financial impact or financial health impact on their customer base. And, well, how are you going to do that unless we have a standardized score and good data that really proves that the scores are valid or not? So I think we've got some work to do over the next couple of years. And to their credit, there's some smart folks and smart firms working on it, like MX, like Financial Health Network in Chicago, who's doing great work around this, and some other folks who are kind of focusing on this problem.
Well, we've talked about focusing on the customer and addressing problems, but is there any technology that you see that kind of excites you that you think, oh, this could really be interesting or helpful?
Well, at the expense of telling you say something that everybody kind of knows, I think there's huge potential for the impact of AI on a lot of different areas. I still think that some of the hype is a little too loud and not very focused. And you know, the idea that we're going to have all these great advice that's being provided, but you know, there's with better data collection, I think there's going to be a lot of efficiencies and more convenience that can be added into the financial management mix, not just financial health, but just in terms of how we manage our finances as AI starts to better mature and more importantly, or just as importantly, I should say, as more data is available for that. You still think things like blockchain are kind of a ways off, and you know, I don't think the impact of that's going to be as dramatic as some people. Have you seen, you know, headlines like how blockchain is going to solve world hunger? I mean, let's get real here. In financial services, it's it's really going to be more back office-y kinds of things where that's going to have an impact. But it's just going to take a little bit of time for that to kind of get tested and work itself in. But we'll start to see the efficiencies from that. Over the next couple of years, you know, we'll tell you at the expense of having some friends call me and yell at me and threaten to never work with me again. I'm not as big on some of the chatbot stuff. I'm a customer of one of the big banks who has one of the more popular chatbots out there. And every time I've used it, it has failed me miserably because it either doesn't understand my question or if it does understand the question, it basically says, I don't know, you have to call somebody. Exactly. And I don't think they understand that the whole reason I'm talking to a stupid machine is because I don't want to talk to a person who won't understand my question either. So my personal experience with a lot of these chatbots has been way underwhelming. So not as keyed up on that one.
Yeah, I kind of think of blockchain kind of like Linux. It's an exciting development. It's very efficient. It gets out there, but it's not like people see it in their day-to-day lives, all the efficiency and all the benefits that it's providing on the back end.
Yeah, it reminds me, I hate to tell everybody how old I am, but man, this goes back a ways. And it reminds me of when I was back in business school and I had a buddy who worked for a software development company. We played softball together. Saw him one evening before the game and he looked like he was in a pretty good mood. I'm like, Rob, what's going on? Well, you look things good at work? And he goes, yeah, really good at work today. We finally decided we're going to use a relational database. And I'm like, okay. That's, you know, that was exciting to him. And that's how I kind of feel like blockchain is. Ooh, hey, we're going to use blockchain. Okay, good. You know, we rest of the world here, we don't really care. And we're looking forward to seeing it when it comes out. But, you know, it's one of those things where I don't think it's going to sort of have the customer facing impact that that so many folks are talking about. The other thing, and again, that, I think this is one of those longer term things that remains to be seen throughout the course of the decade is, you know, what impact is cryptocurrency going to have? You know, today it's really more focused on it being an investment class or investment asset. But, there's a bunch of companies working on trying to integrate it in from a payment perspective. And I don't just mean like Overstock.com taking Bitcoin. I'm talking about, you know, what Facebook is trying to do with Libra. You know, by the way, just as an aside, I had somebody asked me recently, hey, do you know any good fintech jokes? And I said, yeah, Libra. And so I guess that one didn't go over real well.
That's good.
But, you know, look at what Walmart is doing or attempting to do by announcing a cryptocurrency. JP Morgan Chase with JPM Coin. Less about the retail side, but more about cross-border transfers. A lot of interesting stuff going on. The whole potential impact of digital currency. We're way too early for that. You know, obviously a lot of other countries are moving ahead a lot faster, in particular China. But I'm not as worried about that from a competitive perspective. But you know, it'll be interesting to kind of see what kind of impact that has on the banks, mostly from a payment perspective. And that's another thing that I think a lot of the banks need to have on their radar.
Well, you mentioned China, and that makes me think of all the stuff going on over there. It seems like they have a model for a post-cash and, well, also highly monitored by the government system. But do you see a lot of that being able to be transferred to the future in the U.S.?
Yes and no. We're you know, obviously seeing huge upticks now already in terms of mobile payment adoption because of the COVID crisis. People have been forced to make more digital payments, and you know, there's sort of an anti-cash kind of movement that has accelerated a little bit because of the health ramifications of that. But the system in China is very different because, I mean, they basically regulated this. And remember, they didn't have a strong credit card or debit card base of consumers to start with. So, you know, we're dealing here from a demographic perspective with it still. I know you guys, the Gen Xers and millennials, hate to hear this, but us baby boomers are still, you know, I think like 70 million strong. And, you know, we're not the big fintech and mobile payment users. We're getting there, you know, we're getting there actually. But, you know, there's a demographic aspect to play, and we're just not going to change behavior all that fast when the debit cards and credit cards we use are working for us. You know, there's still now, we've got an issue from a cash perspective when it comes to, you know, inclusion and, you know, economics from an income level perspective, where, you know, people are saying, well, we need to keep cash because, you know, many lower income consumers, you know, prefer and need to use cash. So we have some structural barriers to becoming sort of 100% digital payable or mobile payments. But the, you know, this is just, these are the, you know, you look at the adoption of a lot of technologies, and I've been basically, you know, tracking the adoption of, you know, financial services related technology since 1999. And every time something comes along, you know, someone will do a survey and ask consumers, well, why aren't you adopting this? And they'll give you, you know, 100 reasons why they're not doing it. But over time, I mean, look, remember when even Amazon first came out, you know, and the surveys were, you know, well, would you ever do online shopping? Oh, no, that's not safe. I don't want to give my information and numbers out there. I think people are going to, you know, will have access to this and, you know, a million reasons. And now, you know what, we pretty much all buy from Amazon. You know, it's always this similar, you know, type of you know, migration or transition path to these new technologies. It's never as fast as the pundits, you know, say it's going to be, but it happens. It happens eventually.
Yeah, that's funny you say that. I would have bought Bitcoin much earlier, but there was all those Silk Road things going on and investigations, and I had no idea what might happen if I bought some. But it would have been a little bit more helpful if I'd bought some years earlier. So you're a fintech right now, let's say. What advice do you have for people that are just starting out and creating their own fintechs?
I think the advice would be probably do what a lot of them are already doing, which is focus on some very specific needs and, you know, holes in the delivery capabilities of the existing financial system. I have never been real big on these neobank challenger banks who've come in and said, you know, and listen, I'm not putting words in their mouth. I've interviewed a lot of the CEOs from these companies, and I often ask them, you know, what's the big, you know, problem that you're going to solve by coming into the market? And very often I hear, well, there's huge levels of dissatisfaction with existing banks. Wrong. I don't know where they get their data from. I can show you plenty of data that shows that consumers are plenty happy with the institutions they do business with, and that level of satisfaction is increasing. You know, the idea that, listen, nobody, and I wrote this recently too, nobody wants a digital bank just because it's a digital bank. They want a bank that offers something better than what they already have. And you're not going to outdo Bank of America just because you have a digital bank. That's not what consumers are looking for. They're looking for better products, better services. Yes, the delivery, you might have an edge in terms of user interface and customer experience, but those are the kinds of things where those are not long-term defensible strategic differentiators. Everybody catches up on that. Where it's harder to catch up with is designing products and services that meet certain niches of the market. Because if you're like a USAA focusing in on a specific niche and everybody else is not focused, you've got a sustainable competitive advantage. So, you know, similar things, the fintechs who are starting up might not be focusing on specific niches of the market, but they should be focusing on, you know, specific problem areas, narrowly focused, where the existing set of financial institutions are just not doing a good job today. And I think, you know, some of the examples that we've been talking about here today are good examples of that, like earned wage access and bill negotiation and, you know, cash advances and things like that are big holes. And the lending space has got, you know, huge opportunities. You know, you've got a bunch of players who've come into the market now, you know, doing buy now, pay later with interesting types of approaches that aren't just all about charging, you know, sky high interest rates like some of the previous providers do or have. So, you know, it's about finding those niches and finding those pain points and, you know, really kind of honing in on that. You know, there'll be ways to find ways to just get distribution and scale, but focus on those narrow problems and don't think you're coming in and going to reinvent financial services and, quote, disrupt the market. Now, every time I hear some fintech CEOs that use the word disruption, I think my brain starts to have seizures and my ears shut down.
But Clayton Christensen said. So before we let you go, I do want to get your opinion on one more thing. And it's all over the news, well, this year, constantly. What are your thoughts, and you can pick any angle you'd like, on Robinhood?
At the end of last year, I did an article on the five biggest winners and losers of you know, fintech. And I think I did that the year before as well. And I have consistently put them in the biggest losers category, which of course is making a lot of people wonder, well, Ron, what the hell is wrong with you? This company's valuation is going through the roof. I simply don't think that that's a defensible, sustainable valuation. They're certainly adding a lot of clients, but their revenue base, I think, is squishy and not defensible. And, you know, listen, they may, you know, I'll tell you more in a couple of weeks after I field the survey where I'm going to ask consumers about, you know, specifically around their relationship with Robinhood and what other types of products and services they might be interested in doing. Listen, I don't think it's evil. I mean, I know they took a lot of heat for some of the things that have happened recently, but I just don't think it's a defensible valuation, and I don't see a sustainable business model that's going to enable them to profitably grow.
So the WeWork of fintech?
Maybe not go that far, because WeWork, you know, they were a little more sketchy. I don't think
even more
sketchy.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Well, thanks for joining us this week on the podcast. A really interesting talk.
Thanks a lot for having me, guys.
Yeah, thank you. That's Ron Shevlin, the senior contributor at Forbes, who talks a lot about fintech in there, the director of research at Cornerstone Advisors, and the author of the Fintech Snark Tank. Please hit subscribe to keep up with this and the latest in fintech news, and thank you for listening.